This is Noisy People. I'm Tim Perkis. Today my guest is scat singer slash nuclear physicist Lauren Benedict. But before I get into talking with Lauren, since this is episode number one of the Noisy People podcast, I thought I should take a minute to tell you just what the hell this is. Some years ago, I made a documentary film about the San Francisco experimental and improvisational music scene called Noisy People, which consisted of 8 biographical sketches of active musicians in the area. Making that movie didn't seem to get rid of my itch to look into the lives of musicians and their work, so this podcast is really a way to continue that process. For each episode, I'm going to talk to usually just one musician or sound artist, and we'll listen to samples of their work. The shows will run probably between 15 and 30 minutes each. And as far as style goes, or genre, experimental, improvisational, and electronic music is the core of my interest. But really, the only limitation is that I'll be looking at people and work that I find interesting for whatever reason. This is Lauren Benedict, voice, and Sam Ospavat, drums, from their album Passwords. So, scat singing, wordless vocal improvisation, has been an integral part of jazz from the very beginning. A characteristic feature of jazz is that there are improvised instrumental solos injected into the playing of pop or dance tunes. From early on, singers have wanted to get in on that fun as well, and not just be stuck with singing the melody or head, as they call it. The way they've done it is through the use of nonsense syllables that mimic, in some way, the articulations and rhythms possible with musical instruments. From Al Jolson in 1911, Louis Armstrong, the most influential of all, in 1928, Cab Calloway, 1932, and on through jazz history with Ella Fitzgerald, Joe Williams, John Hendrix, Dave Lambert, Sammy Davis Jr., who seems to be able to do everything, Sarah Vaughan, and many, many other greats. And now to look at Lauren Benedict. Lauren is doing something that's a little different. He's taking it really beyond the borders of what is normally thought of as jazz. And in a series of groups and projects he has co-led, is doing things that seem sometimes like a kind of contemporary fugal chamber music, or a variant of hip-hop, or some kind of free improvisation that retains the harmonic sophistication of traditional or hard bop jazz. He also brings a strange and idiosyncratic linguistic quality to his scat vocalizations that really is just his own thing. You'll never hear him singing the head in English. He's 100% scat all the time. We sat down and talked in my studio a couple of days ago. Well, your thing is so interesting and so unique, I think. I was wondering where it came from.
Okay, well, there are a number of ways I can answer that question. The first is that I come from a family of professional musicians that are not improvisers, but that are symphonic musicians, actually, in various orchestras. And so I was listening to music all my life, And my dad, it was a fan of jazz, actually a very different type of jazz than I'm currently interested in, but I would ransack his record collection and listen to stuff a lot. And so part of it is just sort of a long love of music of various types, be it classical or jazz. And I always had a head towards structure. I mean, specifically, like my mom used to say to me when I was older, that one of the things that was striking to her when I was a little kid is that I would be singing these inner voicings from symphonic things that they were playing in the orchestras when they would take me to rehearsal. The other thing that is a little weird is that I'm not a schizophrenic, but I don't think, but I do have of almost like a pathological tendency to make up words. And this has started from when I was really very little. I don't remember when it would have started, but was expressed most when my sister was born, which was when I was 6 years old. And I was sort of forced upon her this kind of language of my own design, which was actually didn't have any meaning associated with it. So I couldn't have even told you what the words, quote unquote, words meant. But we would have these conversations where it was kind of more about feeling, but with very specific phonemes or words that would be repeated. And then when I started singing many years later, it evolved into me using stuff that was not unlike the things that my sister and I would be saying.
Even with all the fabulous kind of variety of scat singers that are out there, and all these great singers throughout the century, right? It's all kind of shooby-dooby-doo, mainly. You know what I mean? There's a certain kind of level of kind of phonemic creativity to what you're doing that is not really... You don't really hear in other people's.
You certainly don't hear that much, but let me say a few things. Even though I'm not really a singer-singer in the sense that I kind of think of myself more as an instrumentalist in the way that I function in typical groups, I do pay attention to singers, both old and new. And what I have seen myself is that the singers that devote themselves more to improvisation, even the ones in the straight-ahead jazz idiom, They always, not sometimes, they always have a more nuanced sort of collection of phonemes. And I think what I attribute this to is just that the more you do something, you know, the usual shit ends up sounding boring after a while.
The scat singers that have some kind of more rhythmic complexity, I mean, that's I can see that as they're naturally kind of fall into these more different phonemes too.
That's right.
To express that kind of rhythmic,
right.
These different rhythmic things. But there's also the sense that, you know, and this is what I think people see this with glossolalia, the different kinds of, you
right.
know, speaking in tongues, religious people do and so on.
Right.
That they just kind of stick to the phonemes of their native language.
Mm-hmm.
They're not really like creating a new language. They're actually working within the sounds of their language.
Maybe that's
which
right.
Which you don't seem to do.
Well.
And I just wondered the process of... You know, I was, I don't know if I ever told you this. I was hearing you, Kjell Nordsen, the Swedish drummer
sure.
that you and I know.
Yeah.
Were listening to you, and he looked at me, he said, man, that sounds like Swedish to me.
Well, what I typically get is people think it sounds like German, and I get a lot of times Yiddish. And, of course, it is true that a part of my background is actually the Ashkenazi Jew background. Now, I didn't grow up knowing anything about Yiddish or Hebrew or German.
You didn't have
matter.
anybody in your family that
no,
spoke Yiddish or
not
in
even
household or...
not even close. I mean, I think it's just, I mean, I it's just sort of in my bones. I don't know what it is. But getting back to this sort of made-up language with my sister, I always was kind of compelled, and I'm still like this. I mean, if you talk to my wife, I mean, she knows me well enough that, I mean, I'm still doing this. I like for instance, the thing that I used to say to my sister all the time, and it didn't really mean anything, but we would say it, was Ruhigfried Neuert. I mean, literally, I would just, and then she would say it, and I would correct, when I was a little kid, I would correct her because she would say it wrong. It's Neuert, Neuert, and you had to use you had to open your throat in a certain way, Neuert. So, I mean, why am
That's
I doing that?
That's a Yiddish-sounding thing, yeah.
Maybe, see, I don't know, but I mean, I don't know why, but it's just, it's sort of, I'm compelled to do stuff like that. And I think that, you know, of course, when I first started singing, I didn't have anywhere near the confidence to be that bold to do something that would. But now, I'm at a stage now where I feel like there's no barriers and I can literally do anything.
Did you get the idea of doing this kind of singing and then kind of find out about scat tradition and so on in jazz? Or did you sort of, or was it kind of that you absorbed a lot of it and started taking that kind of linguistic
thing? Well, what I really absorbed was a lot of instrumental articulation. So, I mean, again, growing up in a family of instrumentalists, I'm not claiming that it sounds like that. Now it sounds like a human language. But the beginnings of what I would have done, if you had heard it, let's say, 12 years ago or 13 years ago, I think it would have sounded not like specific instrumental emulation, but something that is like, okay, he's articulating like he had keys, you know, that he was pushing. And then it just got more like this because I also have listened to singers since I was a kid, too. I love Nat King Cole. I love Carmen McRae. And the singers that I like the most are the ones that really make very good use of consonants. And where it's not, I mean, I don't like singers that are doing the high school choir thing where it's all vowels, you know.
Right, right.
I like singers that are shaping the notes.
So the articulation, you know, of the kind
exactly.
of the rhythmic aspect of it.
That's right. And, of course, I also grew up during the beginnings of hip-hop, and I grew up in a community which was kind of a checkerboard of Caucasian and African American, and a lot of my best friends were black. And I remember when Run DMC's first stuff came out, and we learned all of that, and I was learning to sing along to that, and so that the hip hop thing is, it looms large in my musical psyche as well.
This is from the CD Home Is Where the House Is by Lauren and Molly Gamir. Fight, they could be your heart, the little wink of a home, but with the wood switched, sing me your heart with the wind, mother who wind in my high bank window, but with the wiggle phone, walk with the wood is in your heart. Vagabond, you beg you, waha. Vagabond, you vote, waha. The ease, the travel. The ease, the travel. Scatting is like a mock instrumental solo in the traditional use,
mm-hmm.
But you've like taken the meat out of the sandwich and thrown away the rest of the sandwich. You know, I have a friend, Gabe, who's like a philosopher, and he writes these papers that are just every sentence, every paragraph is like full bore. There's no breaks, right? There's no kind of ebb and flow in the sense that like, okay, this is the intense part, and now we're going to back off a little bit and maybe summarize a little about where we are. And so if you take this stuff that's just the concentrated moment of ecstasy in this piece, right, does it work? Does it still work in that context? And how do you give it the kind of...
Well, that's a really
good question. The equivalent
of
a sort of... when you're singing the head, it's like it's just a relaxation thing
that's
before you
point.
Plunge in, right? So there's got to be an equivalent of that.
That's right. I think there's a couple things I can say to that. One is I will freely admit that I'm a maximalist. That's just who I am. That doesn't mean that I think that that's aesthetically better than a more tempered or, you know, approach towards minimalism or whatever. It's just that that's who I am. I'm kind of a fidgety guy. But the other thing is that, you know, the performances that I do in these kinds of groups tend to be very short. The sets are sometimes 20 minutes long. They're never much more than a half hour. And for exactly that reason,
right.
I don't want it to... I mean, it's tiring for me to listen to it, even though I'm doing it and even though I like doing it. It's I can only take so much of it. Casey can only take so much of this, you
right.
know? And so...
I mean, I love this KGB trio where it's just like you with Casey Knudsen and
mm-hmm.
Ben Goldberg,
yeah,
and they're reed players, and it's just this sort of continuous variation, kind of
yep.
a fugal
yep.
kind of thing that
yeah,
but like not any kind of, I mean it's like you can tell that they're behind it is kind of jazz technology in
yeah,
a way
right,
in the sense
right.
of like. You know, some kind of framework of
mm-hmm.
playing changes and so on, but without any of those things kind of directly expressed in any way. There's nobody playing chords. There's nobody.
That's right.
No comping going on.
One, two, We're always trying to stick very rigorously to forms, and all the forms we do play have harmonic elements and everything. And it depends kind of on how much one knows. I mean, the people that are in this business that are jazz musicians, they hear the tunes that we're playing right away. I remember right. that when you, I know that you like the group very much, but there were times when I think you heard us at Berklee Arts and you told me that you didn't know what the tunes were that we played because we didn't play the heads. But there were other people in the audience who did know.
Right.
And
sure.
so it's also, I mean, that's just the nature of the way this, it is an elitist kind of a thing a little bit. But the fact that people would like the thing without knowing what the tune is, of course, is very important to me. If it was just for the jazz nerds, then I wouldn't really, you know, what's the point then?
Right. Now, that's the thing that's interesting to me about the sort of liminal aspect of what you're doing and how it's kind of on the edge of sort of different genres.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you're obviously full of jazz.
Yep.
It's full of knowledge of working with changes and working in a context of harmonic flow kind of. But at the same time, you know, I've dispensed with most of the other structural elements. You know, it's got something to do with free improvisation and
sure.
But, you know, it isn't free improvisation exactly. Generally.
No,
well, I've heard.
Well,
of you.
You know, I mean there are a lot of us that come from structure rigorous structure that are really into this more left of center sort of variant of improvised music. A lot of us really kind of reject the notion that there is such a thing as free improvisation.
Uh-huh.
And I'm one of those people. So, I mean, I think that if you're really...
So what do you mean that it doesn't exist?
Well, I think that there's always going to be... In order for people to play music, there has to be something that's agreed upon, even if it's not a song form per se. I mean, there are very specific tropes that people follow.
Yeah.
The way that they, you know, when they decide to end a thing, when they, how they, you know... And I think that, you know... That's the way it should be. I mean, there's shared knowledge and understanding of stuff, and you're building something. And, I mean, I certainly think that when I've heard, you know, a free improvisers from Berlin versus people who are from Philadelphia, it's totally different.
This is Bleeding Vector, the duo of Lauren and Eric Vogler on guitar. So how does your thing go down in jam sessions, in like these jazz-oriented jazz sessions?
Great.
People dig it.
Yeah, I mean,
it's accepted.
Oh yeah, I mean it's. I mean, I'm not trying to be big-headed about it, but that's where I really shine. See, because you've only really heard me in the context of what you're talking about, which is this kind of stripped-down thing, which is the main thing I'm interested in. Don't get me wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean the jam sessions I go to, and whether it's in New York or when I show up at a place like in Denver, if I'm at a conference and literally nobody knows me, they tend to dig it because they can hear right away. This is a guy. He knows what he's doing. Most singers don't know what they're doing. You know, he's trying to be one of us,
right.
And we appreciate that. You know, because we're kind of speaking the same language. And the interesting thing I should say is that with the people that are really the sort of dyed-in-the-wool jazz instrumentalists, they rarely really mention the language thing. It's not that they don't hear it. It's that that's not the thing that sticks out for them. The thing that sticks out for them is, wow, this guy actually was playing giant steps, you know, or whatever, trying to at least, you know,
yeah,
or whatever.
Right. Yeah. I wanted to talk to you a little bit about your day job, too. What is your day job?
So I'm a physicist. I'm a theoretical and computational, mostly theoretical, condensed matter physicist. And I do a little bit of work also in plasma physics. Plasma is an ionized gas. And I work for a government laboratory, Lawrence Livermore National Lab, and I've been there for a little over 16 years. And before that, I was a postdoc at another government lab outside of Washington, D.C., and then before that, I was a graduate student at Berkeley. You know, I spend most of my time thinking about properties of materials, mostly in extreme conditions of pressure and temperature, like at the center of large planets or in stars and things like this. And we do a lot of work at Lawrence Livermore Lab in support of trying to eventually make a nuclear fusion as a power source a reality, as we're still a bit of ways from that. And so I work quite a bit on that and other related things.
I guess I'm interested if you feel like there's any kind of bearing on your music or how the music and your work relate.
I think the way in which they relate the most for me is not actually anything having to do with what they're really about. A lot of people, especially musicians that have a kind of a heady approach to what they're doing, which is many people that I like and that I know. There are a number of people who have pressed me on this point of, you know, more overt connections between the actual subject matter of what I study and music. And of course, people have said, I think correctly, that music is a mathematical thing. It's about relationships. And so at least, there is certainly a lot of mathematical information in anything that any musician has ever done. But again, for me, I've never really felt like it made sense for me personally to try to make a more overt connection like this. If I were to make a piece of music that was really, I don't know, which had as a libretto, so to speak, you know, something that I or somebody else is doing or trying to do in science, it would have to be so boiled down from the point of view of the scientific element that it would just be silly. It would be a caricature of the scientific thing.
Yeah. So I wanted to touch also on this area of idiom, maybe genre and idiom, you know. Yeah. Speaking most broadly, the kind of music we're talking about is music that is always kind of passing these sort of borders, you know, transgressing these kind of borders about idiom and so on. And there's a way in which genre is just, you know, it's kind of an artificial after-the-fact classification of, I think somebody said there's no art, there's only artists, you know, as a very short way to say this.
Who said that? That's great.
I don't know, but it's
very interesting.
Music theory, say, is like, you know, is the theory of what people were doing.
Yes, that's right.
And the doing is the first thing.
That's right. I myself, as I think many musicians that I play with and that I like, we don't spend a lot of time obsessing about whether we're jazz or whether we're not jazz or this kind of thing. I mean, but anytime you have a collection of people where there are well-defined expectations, we can call that a genre or not. I personally like that. I like it because it then means that there's a there, and I'm now in a situation where in order for me to get to the point where I can understand what they're doing or play with these people or whatever, I have some work to do, which is always good, in my opinion. It's always good to be faced with assignments, I think. And that's why I get excited by what you might call genre. In the same way, I have to say that this goes beyond just the area of music. I also don't like thinking about, you know, when people talk about a post-racial society or whatever, that's exactly not the world I want to live in, you know. I want there to be a black culture, and I want there to be an Italian culture, and I want there to be a Native American culture. And yes, we can live together and do things, but I want really distinct flavors of things. And I think I'm like that in every area of my life.
You know, I think that's a perfectly reasonable way to be. Okay. Well, are we done?
Sure.
I guess we're done.
This has been the Noisy People Podcast, episode number 1. My special thanks for this edition go to Lauren Benedict, Philip Greenleaf, Claudia LaRocca, and the Hot Pot House in Oakland, California. And always to my audio guru, Philip Perkins, who isn't to blame for anything that's wrong with this show. I did it all. The podcast is now or will shortly be available through iTunes subscription, on SoundCloud, and at the website noisypeople.net, where you can also find images, unedited versions of the interviews, and links to music and people referred to in the show. Noisy People is a project of Artifact Recordings, and this episode was produced in February 2015.